Chapter 6 Arnie Kott owned the only harpsichord on Mars. However, it was out of tune, and he could find no one to service it. No matter which way you cut it, there were no harpsichord tuners on Mars. For a month now, he had been training his tame Bleakman to tackle this task. Bleakman had a fine ear for music, and his particular one seemed to understand what Arnie wanted. Heliogabalus had been provided with a translation into the Bleaky dialect of a manual on keyboard instrument maintenance, and Arnie expected results any day now. But meanwhile, the harpsichord was virtually unplayable. Back in Lewistown, from his visit to Anne Esterhazy, Arnie Kott felt glum. The death of the black market goodies man, Norbert Steiner, was a solid blow below the belt, and Arnie knew that he would have to make a move, probably a drastic and unprecedented one, to compensate for it. It was now 3 o'clock in the afternoon. What had he gotten out of his trip to New Israel? Only a piece of bad news. Anne, as usual, could not be talked into anything. She intended to go right on with her amateurish campaigns and causes, and if she were the laughing stock of Mars, it did not matter to her. "God damn you, Heliogabalus," Arnie said with fury. "You get that goddamn instrument playing right, or I'm kicking you out of Lewistown. You can go back to eating beetles and roots in the desert with the rest of your kind." Seated on the floor beside the harpsichord, the Bleakman winced, glanced up acutely at Arnie Kott, then lowered his eyes to the manual once more. "Nothing ever gets fixed around here," Arnie grumbled. All Mars, he decided, was a sort of Humpty Dumpty. The original state had been one of perfection, and they and their property had all fallen from that state into rusty bits and useless debris. He felt sometimes as if he'd presided over an enormous junkyard. And then, once more, he thought about the Yi Company repair copter which he had run into in the desert, and the Zwep piloting it. "Independent bastards," Arnie said to himself. "Ought to be taken down a peg or two." But they knew their worth. Vital to the economy of the planet, it was written on their faces. "We bow to no man," etc. Arnie paced about the big front room of the Lewistown house, which he maintained in addition to his apartment at Union Hall, hands in his pockets, scowling. "Imagine, that guy talked back to me just like that," Arnie reflected. "He must be a hell of a good repairman to be so confident." And Arnie also thought, "I'm going to get that guy if it's the last thing I do. Nobody talks to me like that and gets away with it." But of the two thoughts about the Yi Company uppity repairman, the former slowly began to dominate his mind because he was a practical man and knew that things had to be kept running. Codes of conduct had to come second. "We're not running a medieval society here," Arnie said to himself. "If the guy's really good, he can say what he wants to me. All I care about is results." With that in mind, he telephoned the Yi Company at Bunchwood Park and soon had Mr. Yi himself on the line. "Listen," Arnie said. "I got a sick encoder over here, and if you fellows can get it working, maybe I can use you on a permanent contract basis. You follow me?" There was no doubt of it. Mr. Yi followed him, all right. He saw the entire picture.
"Our best man, sir, right away. And I know we'll give absolute satisfaction any hour of the day or night."
"I want one particular man," Arnie said, and he thereupon described the repairman he had met in the desert.
"Young, dark-haired, slender?" Mr. Yi repeated. "Glasses and with a nervous manner? That would be Mr. Jack Bolin, our finest."
"Let me tell you," Arnie said, "that this guy Bolin talked to me in a way I don't let nobody talk to me. But after I thought it over, I realized he was in the right, and when I see him, I'm going to tell him that to his face." However, in actuality, Arnie Kott no longer could recall what the issue had been. "That guy Bolin seems to have a good head on him," he wound up. "Can he get over here today?" Without hesitation, Mr. Yi promised service by 5 o'clock. "I appreciate that," Arnie said. "And be sure and tell him that Arnie holds no grudges. Sure, I was taken aback at the time, but that's all over. Tell him," he pondered. "Tell Bolin he's got absolutely nothing to worry about regarding me." He rang off then and sat back with a feeling of grim, honest accomplishment. So the day, after all, wasn't a total waste. And, too, he had gotten an interesting bit of information from Anne while over at New Israel. He had brought up the topic of the rumored goings-on in the FDR Mountains, and as usual, Anne knew a few inside yarns emanating from home, accounts no doubt garbled in the chain of oral tellings.
yet the nugget of veracity was there. The UN back home was in the process of staging one of its periodic coups. It was going to descend on the FDR Mountains in another couple of weeks and lay claim to them as public domain land belonging to no one, which was palpably true. But why was it that the UN wanted a big hunk of worthless real estate? There, Anne's tale got perplexing. One story noised about back at Geneva was that the UN intended to build an enormous supranational park, a sort of Garden of Eden, to lure emigrants out of Earth. Another had it that the UN engineers were going to make a vast final attack on the problem of beefing up the power sources on Mars. They were going to set up a huge hydrogen atomic energy power plant, unique in both size and scope. The water system would be revitalized, and with adequate sources of power, heavy industry could at last move over to Mars, taking advantage of free land, light gravity, low taxation. And then another rumor had it that the UN was going to set up a military base in the FDR Mountains to offset United States and Soviet plans along the same general lines. Whichever rumor was true, one fact stuck out. Certain parcels of land in the FDR range were going to be acutely valuable pretty soon. The entire range was up for sale right now, in pieces varying from half an acre to 100,000 acres, and at a staggeringly low price. Once speculators got wind of the UN's plans, this would change. No doubt the speculators were already beginning to act. To claim land on Mars, they had to be on the spot. It could not be done from home. That was the law. So one could expect the speculators to start coming over any time now, if Anne's rumors were correct. It would be like the first year of colonization when speculators were active everywhere. Seating himself at his out-of-tune harpsichord, Arnie opened a book of Scarlatti sonatas and began to bang away at one of his favorites, a cross-hand one on which he had been practicing for months. It was strong, rhythmic, vigorous music, and he pounded the keys with delight, ignoring the distorted sound itself. Heliogabalus moved further off to study his manual. The sound hurt his ears. "I've got a long playing record of this," he said to Heliogabalus as he played. "So goddamn old and valuable that I don't dare play it."
"What is a long playing record?" the bleakman asked.
"You wouldn't understand if I told you. Glenn Gould playing. It's 40 years old. My family passed it down to me. It was my mother's. That guy could really hammer these cross-hand sonatas out."
His own playing discouraged him, and he gave up. "I could never be any good," he decided, "even if this instrument were in peak condition like it was before I had it shipped here from home." Seated on the bench but not playing, Arnie ruminated once more on the golden opportunities involved in the FDR Mountains land. "I could buy in any time," he thought, "with union funds. But where? It's a big range. I can't buy it all." "Who knows that range?" he asked himself. "That Steiner probably did, because as I understand it, his base of operations is, or rather was, someplace near there. And there are prospectors coming and going. And Bleakman lived there, too." "Helio," he said, "do you know the FDR range?"
"Mister, I do know them," the Bleakman said. "I shun them. They are cold and empty and have no life."
"Is it true," Arnie said, "that you Bleakman have an oracular rock that you go to when you want to know the future?"
"Yes, mister. The uncivilized Bleakman have that. But it is vain superstition. Dirty Nobby, the rock is called."
"You never consult it yourself?"
"No, mister."
"Could you find that rock if necessary?"
"Yes, mister."
"I'll give you $1, Arnie said, "if you take a question to your goddamn Dirty Nobby rock for me."
"Thank you, mister, but I cannot do it."
"Why not, Helio?"
"It would proclaim my ignorance to consult with such fraudulency."
"Christ," Arnie said, disgusted. "Just as a game. Can't you do that for a joke?" The Bleakman said nothing, but his dark face was tight with resentment. He pretended to resume his reading of the manual. "You fellows were stupid to give up your native religion," Arnie said. "You showed how weak you are. I wouldn't have. Tell me how to find Dirty Nobby, and I'll ask it myself. I know goddamn well that your religion teaches that you can foretell the future. And what's so peculiar about that? We've got extrasensory individuals back home, and some of them have precognition, can read the future. Of course, we have to lock them up with the other nuts, because that's a symptom of schizophrenia, if you happen to know what that means."
"Yes, mister," Heliogabalus said. "I know schizophrenia. It is the savage within the man."
"Sure, it's the reversion to primitive ways of thought.
But so what if you can read the future? In those mental health camps back home, there must be hundreds of precogs. And then a thought struck Arnicott. Maybe there are a couple here on Mars at Camp BG. The hell with Dirty Knobby Rock, then, Arnie thought. I'll drop by BG one day before they close it and get me a precog nut. I'll bail him out of the camp and put him on the payroll right here in Lewistown. Going to his telephone, he called the union steward, Edward L. Goggins. Eddie, he said when he had hold of the steward, you trot over to our psychiatric clinic and collar those doctors, and you bring back a description of what a precog nut is like, I mean, what symptoms, and if they know one at Camp BG, we could nab. Okay, Arnie, will do. Who's the best psychiatrist on Mars, Eddie? Oh, gosh, Arnie, I'd have to check into it. The truckers have a good one, Milton Glaub. Reason I know that is my wife's brother is a trucker and got analysis from Glaub last year, plus naturally effective representation. I suppose this Glaub knows BG pretty good. Oh, yeah, Arnie, he's over there once a week. They all take turns. The Jews pay pretty good. They've got so much dough to spend. They get the dough from Israel back on Earth, you know. Well, get hold of this Glaub and tell him to rustle up a precog schizophrenic for me as soon as possible. Put Glaub on the payroll, but only if you have to. Most of those psychiatrists are aching for regular money. They see so little of it. Understand, Eddie? Right, Arnie. The steward rang off. You ever been psychoanalyzed, Helio? Arnie said to him, feeling cheerful now.
No, mister. Entire psychoanalysis is a vain, glorious foolishness.
How's that, Helio?
Question they never deal with is, what do remold sick person like? There is no what, mister.
I don't get you, Helio.
Purpose of life is unknown, and hence way to be is hidden from the eyes of living critters. Who can say if perhaps the schizophrenics are not correct? Mister, they take a brave journey. They turn away from mere things, which one may handle and turn to practical use. They turn inward to meaning. There the black night without bottom lies, the pit. Who can say if they will return? And if so, what will they be like, having glimpsed meaning? I admire them.
Gee Reist, Arnie said with derision. You half-educated freak. I'll bet if human civilization disappeared from Mars, you'd be right back there among those savages in 10 seconds flat, worshipping idols and all the rest of it. Why do you pretend you want to be like us? Why are you reading that manual? Heliogabalus said,
Human civilization will never leave Mars, mister. That is why I study this book.
Out of that book, Arnie said, you better be able to tune up my goddamn harpsichord, or you will be back in the desert, whether human civilization stays on Mars or not.
Yes, sir,
his tame Bleakman said. Ever since he had lost his union card and could not then legally perform his job, Otto Zitti's life had been a continual mess. With a card, he would be by now a first-class repairman. It was his secret that he had once held such a card and had managed to lose it. Even his employer, Norb Steiner, did not know it. For reasons he himself did not understand, Otto preferred others to believe he had simply failed the aptitude tests. Perhaps it was easier to think of himself as a failure. After all, the repair business was almost impossible to get into, and after having gotten into it, to be booted out. It was his own fault. There he had been, 3 years ago, a paid-up member of the union in good standing, in other words, a bona fide good member. The future was wide open for him. He was young, he had a girlfriend and his own copter, the latter leased, the former, although he had not known it at the time, shared. And what could hold him back? What, except possibly his own stupidity? He had broken a union ruling, which was a basic law. In his opinion, it was a foolish ruling, but nonetheless. Vengeance is mine, saith the Extraterrestrial Repairmen's Union, Martian Branch. Wow, how he hated the bastards. His hatred had warped his life, and he recognized that. And he did nothing about it. He wanted it to warp him. He wanted to keep on hating them, the vast monolithic structure, wherever it existed. They had caught him for giving socialized repair. And the hell of it was that it wasn't actually socialized because he expected to get back a profit. It was just a new way of charging his customers, and in a sense not so new anyhow. It was actually the oldest way in the world, a barter system. But his revenue could not be divvied up so that the union got its cut. His trade had been with certain housewives living out in remote tracts, very lonely women whose husbands stayed in the city 5 days a week, coming home only on weekends. Otto, who was good-looking, slender, with long, combed-back black hair, in his account of himself anyhow, had made time with one woman after another, and an outraged husband, on finding out, had, instead of shooting Otto to death, gone instead to the union hiring hall and lodged a formal charge. Repairs without compensation at scale. Well, it certainly was not scale, he admitted that. And so now this job with Norb Steiner, which meant that he had practically to live in the wastelands of the FDR Mountains, alienated from society for weeks on end, growing more and more lonely, more embittered all the time. It had been his need for intimate personal contact that had gotten him into trouble in the first place, and now look at him. As he sat in the storage shed waiting for the next rocket to show up, he looked back on his life and reflected that even the Bleakman wouldn't be willing or able to live as he lived, cut off from everyone like this. If only his own black market operations had succeeded. He, like Norb Steiner, had been able to swing around the planet daily, visiting one person after another. Was it his fault that the items he chose to import were hot enough to interest the big boys? His judgment had been too good. His line had sold too well. He hated the big racketeers, too, same as he hated the big unions. He hated bigness per se. Bigness had destroyed the American system of free enterprise. The small businessman had been ruined. In fact, he himself had been perhaps the last authentic small businessman in the solar system. That was his real crime. He had tried to live the American way of life instead of just talking about it. "Screw them," he said to himself, seated on a crate, surrounded by boxes and cartons and packages and the workings of several dismantled rocket ships which he had been revamping. Outside the shed window, silent, desolate rock hills, with only a few shrubs dried up and dying as far as the eye could see. And where was Norb Steiner right now? No doubt ensconced in some bar or restaurant or some woman's cheery living room, prattling his line, handing over tins of smoked salmon and getting in return. "Screw them all," Otto mumbled, getting up to pace back and forth. "If that's what they want, let them have it. Bunch of animals." Those Israeli girls. That's where Steiner was, with a kibbutz full of them. Those hot, black-eyed, heavy-lipped, big-breasted, sexy ones who got tanned working out in the fields in shorts and cotton shirts clinging to them. No bras, just those big, solid breasts. You could actually see their nipples because the damp fabric stuck to them. That's why he wouldn't let me go with him, Otto decided. The only women he ever saw out here in the FDR range were those stunted, black, dried-out Bleakman women. Not even human, at least not to him. He wasn't taken in by those anthropologists saying that the Bleakmen were from the same stock as Homo sapiens, that probably both planets were colonized a million years ago from one interplanetary race. Those toads? Human? Sleep with one of those? Christ, better to chop it off first. As a matter of fact, here came a party of Bleakmen right now, stepping gingerly with bare feet down the irregular rock surface of a northern hill. On their way here, Otto observed, as usual. He opened the door of the shed, waiting until they had reached him. Four bucks, two of them elderly, one elderly woman, several skinny kids, carrying their bows, their pounding blocks, their paca eggshells. Halting, they regarded him silently, and then one of the bucks said, "Rains are falling from me onto your valuable person." "Likewise," Otto said, leaning against the shed and feeling dull, weighed down with hopelessness. "What do you want?" The Bleakman buck held out a small bit of paper, and Otto, taking it, saw that it was a label from a can of turtle soup. The Bleakman had eaten the soup, retaining the label for this purpose. They could not tell him what they wanted because they did not know what it was called. "Okay," he said. "How many?" He held up fingers. At five, they nodded. Five cans. "What you got?" Otto demanded, not stirring. One of the young Bleakman women stepped forward and pointed to that part of herself which had been so much in Otto's thoughts for so long. "Oh, Christ," Otto said in despair. "No, go on, beat it. Not anymore. I don't want any more." He turned his back on them, made his way into the storage shed, and slammed the door so hard that the shed walls trembled. He threw himself down on a packing crate, his head in his hands. "I'm going crazy," he said to himself,
his jaw stiff, his tongue swelling up so that he could hardly talk. His chest ached. And then, to his amazement, he began to cry. Jesus, he thought in fright. I really am going crazy. I'm breaking down. Why? Tears rolled down his cheeks. He hadn't cried in years. What's this all about? He wondered. His mind had no concept in it. It was only his body bawling away, and he was a spectator to it. But it brought him relief. With his handkerchief, he wiped his eyes, his face, and cursed when he saw that his hands were claw-like with rigidity, the fingers writhing. Outside the window of the shed, the Bleakman remained, perhaps seeing him. He could not tell. Their faces showed no expression, but he felt sure that they must have seen, and probably were as perplexed as he. It sure is a mystery, he thought. I agree with you. The Bleakmen gathered together in a huddle and conferred, and one of them detached himself from the group and approached the shed. Otto heard a rap on the door. Going over to it and opening it, he found the young Bleakman standing there holding out something. This, then, the young Bleakman said. Otto took it, but for the life of him he could not make out what it was. It had glass and metal to it and calibrations. And then he realized that it was an instrument used in surveying. On its side was stamped UN property. I don't want it, he said irritably, turning it over and over. The Bleakman must have stolen it, he realized. He handed it back. The young buck accepted it stoically and returned to his group. Otto shut the door. This time they went off. He watched them through the window as they trailed away up the side of the hill. Steal you blind, he said to himself. Anyway, what was a UN survey company doing in the FDR range? To cheer himself up, he rummaged around until he found a can of smoked frog's legs. Opening it, he sat eating morosely, not getting from the dainty anything at all, and yet methodically finishing the can.
Into the microphone, Jack Boland said, "Don't send me, Mr. Yee. I already ran into Cott today and defended him."
Weariness settled over him. Naturally, I ran into Cott for the first time in my life, and naturally I insulted him, he thought to himself. And just as naturally, because that's how my life works, it's the same day that Arnie Cott decides to call up Yee Company and ask for service. It's typical of the little game I play with the powerful, inanimate forces of life.
"Mr. Cott mentioned meeting you on the desert," Mr. Yee said. "In fact, his decision to call us was based on that meeting."
"The hell you say?"
He was dumbfounded.
"I do not know what the issue was, Jack, but no harm has been done. Direct your ship to Lewistown. If you run over beyond 5 o'clock, you will be paid time and a half. And Mr. Cott, who is known as a generous man, is so anxious to have his encoder working that he promises to see that you receive a bountiful meal."
"All right," Jack said. It was too much for him to dope out. After all, he knew nothing of what went on in Arnie Cott's mind. Not long thereafter, he was lowering his copter to the roof parking lot of the Water Workers Union Hall at Lewistown. A slavey sauntered out and regarded him suspiciously.
"Yee Company repairman," Jack said. "Call put in by Arnie Cott."
"Okay, buddy," the slavey said, and led him to the elevator. He found Arnie Cott in a well-furnished Earth-type living room. The big bald-headed man was on the telephone, and he nodded his head at Jack's appearance. The nod indicated the desk on which a portable encoding dictation machine sat. Jack walked over to it, removed the lid, turned it on. Meanwhile, Arnie Cott continued his phone conversation.
"Sure, I know it's a tricky talent. Sure, there's a good reason why nobody's been able to make use of it. But what am I supposed to do, give up and pretend it don't exist just because people have been too dumb for 50,000 years to take it seriously? I still want to try it."
A long pause.
"Okay, doctor, thanks."
Arnie hung up. To Jack, he said, "You ever been to Camp BG?" "No," Jack said. He was busy opening up the encoder. Arnie strolled over and stood beside him. As he worked, Jack could feel the astute gaze fixed on him. It made him nervous, but there was nothing he could do except try to ignore the man and go on. A little like the master circuit, he thought to himself. And then he wondered, as he often did, if he was going to have another one of his spells. True, it had been a long time, but here was a powerful figure looming close to him, scrutinizing him, and it did feel somewhat like that old interview with Corona's personnel manager.
"That was Glaub on the phone," Arnie Cott said. "The psychiatrist. You ever heard of him?"
"No," Jack said.
What do you do, live your life entirely with your head stuck in the back of machines?
Jack looked up, met the man's gaze. I've got a wife and son. That's my life. What I'm doing right now is a means of keeping my family going.
He spoke calmly. Arnie did not seem to take offense. He even smiled.
Something to drink? Arnie asked.
Coffee, if you have it.
I've got authentic home coffee, Arnie said. Black?
Black.
Yeah, you look like a black coffee man.
You think you can fix that machine right here and now, or are you going to have to take it with you?
I can fix it here.
Arnie beamed.
That's swell. I really depend on that machine.
Where's the coffee?
Turning, Arnie went off dutifully. He rustled about in another room and then returned with a ceramic coffee mug, which he set down on the desk near Jack.
Listen, Bolin, I have a person coming here any minute now. A girl. It won't interfere with your work, will it?
Jack glanced up, supposing the man was being sarcastic, but evidently not. Arnie was eyeing him and then the partly disassembled machine, obviously concerned with how the repair was progressing.
He certainly is dependent on this, Jack decided.
Strange how people cling to their possessions, as if they're extensions of their bodies, a sort of hypochondria of the machine.
You'd think a man like Arnie Kott could scrap this encoder and shell out the money for a new one.
There sounded a knock on the door, and Arnie hurried to open it.
Oh, hi, his voice came to Jack. Come on in. Hey, I'm getting my doodad fixed.
The girl's voice said, Arnie, you'll never get your doodad fixed.
Arnie laughed nervously. Hey, meet my new repairman, Jack Bolin. Bolin, this is Doreen Anderton, our union treasurer.
Hi, Jack said. Out of the corner of his eye, he did not stop working. He could see that she had red hair and extremely white skin and large, wonderful eyes.
Everybody's on the payroll, he thought tartly. What a great world.
What a great union you've got going here for yourself, Arnie.
Busy, isn't he? The girl said.
Oh, yeah, Arnie agreed. These repair guys are bugs on getting the job done right. I mean, these outside guys, not our own. Ours are a bunch of slobs that sit around playing with themselves at our expense. I'm through with them, Dor.
I mean, this guy Bolin is a whiz. He's going to have the encoder working any minute now, aren't you, Jack?
Yeah, Jack said.
The girl said, Don't you say hello, Jack?
Halting his work, he turned his attention on her. He faced her levelly. Her expression was cool and intelligent, with a faintly mocking quality which was peculiarly rewarding and annoying.
Hello, Jack said. I saw your copter on the roof, the girl said.
Let him work, Arnie said peevishly. Give me your coat.
He stood behind her, helping her out of her coat.
The girl wore a dark wool suit, obviously an import from Earth and therefore expensive to an appalling degree.
I'll bet that set the union pension fund back plenty, Jack decided.
Observing the girl, he saw in her a vindication of a piece of old wisdom. Nice eyes, hair, and skin produced a pretty woman, but a truly excellent nose created a beautiful woman. This girl had such a nose, strong, straight, dominating her features, forming a basis for her other features. Mediterranean women reached the level of beauty much more easily than, say, Irish or English women, he realized, because genetically speaking, the Mediterranean nose, whether Spanish or Hebrew or Turkish or Italian, played a naturally greater part in physiognomic organization. His own wife Sylvia had a gay, turned-up Irish nose. She was pretty enough by any standard, but there was a difference. He guessed that Doreen was in her early 30s, and yet she possessed a freshness that gave her a stable quality. He had seen such clear coloration in high school girls approaching nubility, and once in a long while one saw it in 50-year-old women who had perfect gray hair and wide, lovely eyes. This girl would still be attractive 20 years from now, and probably had always been so. He could not imagine her any other way. Arnie, by investing in her, had perhaps done well with the funds entrusted to him. She would not wear out. Even now he saw a maturity in her face, and that among women was rare.
Arnie said to him, We're going out and have a drink. If you get that machine fixed in time...
It's fixed now. He had found the broken belt and had replaced it with one from his toolkit.
Good deal, Arnie said, grinning like a happy child.
Then come on along with us.
To the girl, he explained, We're meeting Milton Glaub, the famous psychiatrist. You probably heard of him. He promised to have a drink with me. I was just talking to him on the phone just now, and he sounds like a top-notch sort of guy.
He whacked Jack loudly on the shoulder. I bet when you landed your copter on the roof, you didn't think you'd be having a drink with one of the solar system's best-known psychoanalysts, did you?
I wonder if I should go along, Jack thought. But why not?
He said, okay, Arnie. Arnie said, Doc Glaub is going to scare up a schizophrenic for me. I need one. I need its professional services.
He laughed, eyes twinkling, finding his own utterance outstandingly funny.
Do you? Jack said. I'm a schizophrenic.
Arnie stopped laughing.
No kidding. I never would have guessed. What I mean is you look all right.
Finishing up the task of putting the encoder back together, Jack said, I am all right. I'm cured.
Doreen said, No one has ever cured of schizophrenia.
Her tone was dispassionate. She was simply stating a fact.
They can be, Jack said, if it's what's called situational schizophrenia.
Arnie eyed him with great interest, even suspicion.
You're pulling my leg. You're just trying to worm your way into my confidence.
Jack shrugged, feeling himself flush. He turned his attention back completely to his work.
No offense, Arnie said. You really are? No kidding? Listen, Jack, let me ask you, do you have any sort of ability or power to read the future?
After a long pause, Jack said, No.
You sure? Arnie said with suspicion.
I'm sure. He wished now that he had turned down flat that invitation to accompany them. The intent questioning made him feel exposed. Arnie was nudging too close, encroaching on him. It was difficult to breathe, and Jack moved around to the far side of the desk to put more distance between himself and the plumber.
What's the matter? Arnie asked acutely.
Nothing. Jack continued working, not looking at either Arnie or the girl. Both of them were watching him, and his hands shook.
Presently, Arnie said, Jack, let me tell you how I got where I am. One talent got me up here. I can judge people and tell what they're like down inside, what they really are, not just what they do and say. I don't believe you. I bet you're lying to me about your precognition. Isn't that right? You don't even have to answer.
Turning to the girl, Arnie said, Let's get ballin'. I want that drink. He beckoned to Jack to follow. Laying down his tools, Jack reluctantly did so.